Oh man, it's so nice to be back in like the studio with like real equipment. It's good to be working with proper villains again. Like, Skyping around the world.
Skyping around the world! Oi! Oi!
Live from the Mundangerous Public Defender's Office in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 131 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about the Lawful Good Alignment, and probably getting into an argument. But first, the Rogue Traders meet an Inquisitor in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Goody Two Shoes just wants to do the right thing in the Character Creation Forge.
So before we do that, we have to mention an appearance that you made.
Yeah, I showed up on the Tome Show with Jeff to talk about Xanathar's Guide. So if you listened to our review and felt like 2.5 hours just wasn't enough time to figure out if you like the book or not, you can go listen to me talk with Jeff along with Ishmael Alvarez from the Tome Show and Jeremiah McCoy from The Basics of the Game about the book. Fair warning, they liked the book a bit more than we did. So
it seems to be a popular opinion.
I think half the time I'm like, okay, but this other thing sucks. Can we just keep that in mind?
Yeah, the cheese stands alone. That's the moral of this story.
So we'll have that a link up in the show notes. Have fun. Listen to the Tome Show. They're good guys. All right. Speaking of me saying that things are not very good.
So not speaking of great guys.
Okay, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And the Rogue Traders have just landed on the surface of the Desert World Malajacht, where they expect to meet a rival Rogue Trader by the name of Lord Captain Duhan Roth. Because you have brought them a special cargo, Ishan, an ancient Imperial reliquary that you salvaged from one of his ships.
Oh yeah, we did. His ship that was stuck in the warp, being harassed by demons, which we cleared with a relatively minor loss of life. And by that I mean all the guys who died were relatively minor people.
Right. I mean, except for the severe wounding to Trix.
That's what fate points are for.
Right.
And brought it back to this guy, because, well, we kind of want to do him a solid because we kind of screwed him over one time.
And you'd kind of like to be in the good graces of one of the two biggest Rogue Trader dynasties in the sector.
Yeah. So, you know, it's pretty, it's an unselfish motivation.
Yeah, totally. Just here to do the right thing with this Imperial reliquary.
Yeah. Now, we're in impressive company. So we roll up with our honor guard, an entire company of special ops. Unfortunately, maybe our entrance is not that grand. We do get dropped to the surface of the planet through a glass storm in a big dumb drop pod.
Yeah, I mean, no one's entrance to this planet is going to be pretty.
Like, for those of you who don't know, this is the way that, like, supplies get dropped from orbit onto a planet.
It's also the way that Imperial Guardsmen get dropped from orbit onto a planet, so it's not really...
And there's a reason that my character left the Navy, okay?
Right, exactly. It's also the way Space Marines get dropped to a planet, but they're also much sturdier than you are.
I think they don't even need the pod.
That's probably true. Yeah, so the upper atmosphere of this planet, Malajacht, is like a raging glass storm. And so obviously that is incredibly dangerous. You were able to, by the skin of your teeth anyway, navigate the storm and make it through to a safe landing at the designated landing zone. And you find that the atmosphere on the surface is not a whole lot better. It's calm, there's no wind, but you trade the glass above for a very fine and like invasive dust that just fills the air and almost falls from the sky like a misty drizzle.
Yeah, glass above, fiberglass below.
Exactly, yeah. So you guys land, and basically, once you arrive there, you see the reason this was the landing zone. There is an Imperial bunker there that was very difficult to detect from above, from orbit. And you realize, as the doors open, that you need to make haste and get in there, because being outside here sucks.
So inside, it's a giant empty hangar bay, but we still try to look pretty cool. The honor guard presents us properly, and a few seconds later, the opposite door of the hangar bay opens, and a pretty similar honor guard enters, escorting four people.
Yeah, so it's actually, they left it empty for you so that you could arrange yourselves in a way that would be presentable.
How nice of them.
Yeah, you know, there's a degree of decorum that we don't often talk about with Rogue Trader, because you guys are so bad at it. But, you know, Rogue Traders are ostensibly, you know, citizens of honor who stick, you know, believe in ritual and the Imperial Creed and those types of things. So as nobility, you treat each other with a certain decorum.
I mean, this is the first time in-game when we've actually met another Rogue Trader.
It's actually the first time in-game you've met any Rogue Trader, because if you recall, your Rogue Trader died before you met him.
In-game.
Right, yeah.
You were like, I can't come up with a voice for this guy, so he's drunk and in the cabin.
Yeah. So the four important figures that are being escorted by this honor guard... obviously, the first one is Lord Captain Duhan Roth himself. He is clad in a gilded leather greatcoat. He's got a tricorn cap with a very elaborate feather, probably from some very exotic species. He has an augmatic monocle over one eye and a power sword just kind of casually slung across his hip.
Yeah, a greatcoat is just like a regular coat, but two-handed.
And, yeah, exactly. It gives you an extra D6 damage.
Yeah. He's also got his adjutant with him, who's cool and casual, but dressed in desperado's leathers. Of course, we can't see his face because it's behind a bandana and glare shades, and he's got a pair of pretty nice-looking pistols on his belt.
Yeah, shiny-hilted pistols. And then the other two figures are cloaked and hooded. You can only kind of tell the shape, and they sort of stay behind. They don't seem to be... crashing your party as much as they are showing up alongside Roth. One of them is this gigantic and hulking figure who's clearly in heavy power armor. The other is tiny and diminutive, sort of shrinking into Roth's shadow almost behind him, out of notice.
And there's a rising crescendo as the music indicates that these are important people.
Exactly. which is actually... you know, Roth's military band playing it.
Right. Actual people back there.
Right.
Well, not people.
Well, but, you know, right. Yeah. Armsmen.
So we exchange titles, as you do. The Felipes, are they still called the Felipes?
Well, yeah, Flair calls them the Felipes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Flair's attendants present him with all of the titles due him as a member of the actual nobility.
Lord Ventium Flair Magnus III of House Nobilis Magnus, the third of his name, the Lion of the Warp, the blah, 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 blah.
We had some other things that we made up in there. Probably shouldn't say on the podcast.
And, you know, he lets you go through the spiel, but as soon as the introductions are done, Roth starts with the cutting remarks, right? Like, he knows who you are. He's dealt with you before, but he can tell you're kind of trying to puff yourselves up a little bit, and he sees right through it.
Hey, I think it's a big deal that he knows who we are.
Hey, you know, you screwed him once, so maybe he's got a long memory.
So that one's shame on us, right?
Right.
Okay. So then it's a bit surprising because he immediately accuses us of piracy for stealing his cargo.
Yeah, so you had to tell him that you had special cargo from the Ambition, and he assumes that you have stolen it from him because he does not find you to be very reputable yourselves. And so he assumes that this is extortion.
And we immediately think, oh, man, that's what we should have done. Oh, we're so stupid.
Right. And you protest, right? You're like, no, but we saved your crew. Like, we went on to the Ambition and brought as many of the survivors as we could with us. And he's just like, I don't know why you think I care about that. Like, they're replaceable.
So he wants to see proof of life, I guess. He wants to see the reliquary to make sure that we've actually got it.
Exactly.
Which is maybe not the best idea because... then I don't know why he wouldn't just take it and murder us. But we don't really have another choice here because we're stuck on this stupid glass planet.
And you're also, you know, inside the defensive perimeter of his entire fleet.
Yeah.
You kind of knew you were walking into a bad situation here, but figured honor would take precedence over ease of dispatching you.
Yeah, fortunately, he's lawful.
Right.
So we bring out the reliquary, and we can tell that everyone assembled there knows what it is. They're like, oh, yep, that's it. When we uncover it, it's still like beaming and flawless, even though it went through a firefight with bolter rounds and explosives and chaotic blood everywhere.
Yeah, it's been dragged through this awful, like, dusty atmosphere, and it's now just sitting in this dimly lit hangar, and yet it still looks like holy, right?
So then the real introductions begin.
Yeah, I mean, you guys start bickering in the classic form of rogue traders, sort of over whether it's a reward for its return or a sale.
We would never sell something like this.
Right, well, because that would be heresy.
But a proper finder's fee, perhaps.
Exactly. So you start having that kind of conversation, and then this silky female voice kind of just cuts it short. Children, silence. It is here. Finally, our work can begin.
Oh, crap.
And the tiny cloaked figure...
Of course.
...steps out from behind Roth, throws back the cowl of its robe, and reveals a full Rosette Inquisitor of the Ordo Hereticus.
God damn it.
And your boy Flair, the Lion of the Warp, he realizes two things pretty quickly. First of all, she is a very powerful psyker. And second of all... She's 14.
And we'll find out exactly how screwed we are next week.
So this week, we are discussing alignment, and specifically, lawful good.
Look, you're absolutely wrong, okay? There is absolutely no way that Batman is lawful good, okay? He is quite obviously chaotic good, because he's the Robin Hood of our times.
Okay. And a thousand arguments were prompted.
Okay, so this is the beginning of a new, I'm going to guess, 9-part series.
Maybe.
On alignments. But since this is going to be the first in the series, let's spend just a little bit of time talking about what in the heck is alignment. So a little bit of history. For those of you who played D&D for a while, you've sort of seen that it changes a little bit. Those of you who aren't playing D&D, the 9-box alignment system that you've seen around in memes everywhere... That originated with D&D, but it is something that has been ported over to other systems just because people really like it or really hate it, but a lot of people like to use it.
Right. It's the system that everybody complains about being incomplete and then decides to argue over which alignments their favorite characters from different series apply to, even though, you know, it's just D&D alignment.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Myers-Briggs.
Right. It's a useful starting point for the discussion, right?
Am I INFP or INFJ? It's very different. Sometimes it varies from day to day. So originally with D&D, there was just the law to chaos axis. So you could be lawful, you could be neutral, or you could be chaotic. The good and evil axis was introduced in 1977, and then that gave us the archetypal 9 alignment boxes.
Yep.
It's mostly been unchanged since then. For some reason, the good-evil axis doesn't show up in 1981's basic set, but then it pops back in again very quickly, and we're back to 9 boxes.
And then 4th edition ruined it all by getting rid of 3 of the boxes for some reason.
Yeah, it became this sort of linear... it became a line that implied that lawful good was gooder than good,
right,
and chaotic evil was eviler than evil.
Yeah, wait, it was lawful good, good... True neutral.
Unaligned.
Oh, unaligned. Yeah, uh-huh. Right. Yeah. And then it was evil and chaotic evil, right?
Yeah. So like lawful evil was gone, which lawful evil is awesome.
Definitely a thing.
And chaotic good, gone.
Right.
Plus some random neutrals that nobody cares about. But 5th edition, back to normal, I guess what we might call normal. 9 boxes, 9 different alignments. Made up of these two axes, good, neutral, evil, and law, neutral, chaos, giving you everything from lawful good through neutral, neutral, which is called true neutral, and on down to chaotic evil. Now, Shane, you sometimes like to talk about active versus passive alignment.
Yeah, it's like a Z-axis for it.
Mm-hmm.
The basic idea here in D&D is that it assumes you're active in whatever your alignment is. And sort of through the history of D&D, alignment has had more metaphysical representation than just, you know, kind of a general description of behavior. And that's sort of where it gets wonky in D&D. But yeah, if you think about a character, you can have an alignment and have a set of beliefs and have a set of behaviors. You can either actively pursue that in a way that tries to make that the steady state of the universe, or you can sort of passively follow it, which is when you come up on a choice, you tend to choose that direction, but like it's not a mantra.
Right. Now, with the modern alignment system, you don't have to use alignment at all. So a character who's sort of passively evil doesn't go out and seek to harm others, but if other people get hurt in the process of things they're doing, fine.
Right.
But because you're not required to choose an alignment, you're not required to act out your alignment anymore. If you're passive, you can probably just ignore it in your game. So mostly in this series, we're going to be talking about characters who are actively attuned to a particular alignment.
Right. This is the paladin who is lawful good and wants to go out and fix the world.
Yeah. Did you know that I am lawful and good?
Right. Exactly.
So alignment describes a character's outlook about the multiverse, or you know, how they feel like they should live their life. Sometimes it also prescribes how they should live their life. Sometimes right. It's an ideal that they are trying to live up to. So the law chaos axis. If you are lawful, you believe in order, duty, you value reliability, you feel like people can't just go around doing whatever they want to do or society's totally going to fall apart.
And then the inverse of that chaos is a belief in personal freedom, in flexibility, in self-expression. You think that mindless obedience and deference to authority crushes the natural human spirit.
And if you're neutral in the middle, it could be either that you feel like a balance is better, or it could be that you just don't really care either way on this particular axis.
Right.
Now, perpendicular to this axis is the good to evil axis. If you are good, you value altruism, respect for life. You think compassion is good to have. A good person will go out of their way to help other people, even if it might result in harm to themselves.
Whereas evil does all the fun stuff. You can be selfish. You can inflict harm on others. You can oppress people. You will seek personal gain, even if it comes at the expense of others.
Sometimes specifically because it comes at the expense of others.
That's chaotic evil sociopath.
All right, so you line up these two axes perpendicular to each other, and you get the nine alignments. So this episode, we are talking about lawful good.
The top left corner.
It's perhaps one of the more argued about alignments, I think.
Right. Well, it's the one that would seem to have the most difficult standards to adhere to.
Yeah, because chaotic evil is, I do whatever I want. I rip people in half.
I'm chaotic. I can do good things if I want to. I don't care.
Yeah, woo, look at me.
Right.
Okay, so what is lawful good? It means that you are both lawful and good at the same time. You value obedience to authority. You also think respect for life is extremely important. And they're probably tied together. One of the reasons you value law and order is that it facilitates respect for life. You like justice and honor. Self-sacrifice is a high ideal. You probably are very interested in helping the downtrodden, usually through lawful means, through the systems that are already in place. And you probably think it's a good idea to follow the orders that you're given, because people who are in a superior position to you are probably there for good reason.
Yeah, so the typical way that you see this in D&D is the knight in shining armor, right? But it could also be the kind-hearted mayor or a soldier who believes they're fighting for a just cause. It also captures sort of like the benevolent dictator who opposes democracy, right? Who thinks, I am a better ruler for the people than the people would be for themselves.
And they might actually be. That's a possibility, especially in these fantasy settings, right?
Right.
And, you know, maybe they're like, 50 years ago, we tried the whole democracy thing. We got a bunch of purges, and that was very bad.
Yeah, it turns out people on the whole are terrible.
It's really better if I'm in charge.
Right.
So the tension, the fun tension in the game results when law conflicts with good. What happens if you are a knight who is sworn to uphold the law and justice, but the authorities that you're reporting to are evil?
Well, then you're Judge Dredd.
A Judge Dredd's lawful neutral, isn't he?
I mean, no. It depends on which reading of it you're, or which version of Judge Dredd, I guess.
And depends on whose jaw is playing him.
Yeah, whose jaw is protruding from his stupid helmet. Good pauldrons, though.
No, the best pauldrons.
I mean, second best behind Chaos Space Marines.
Or you can have a Lawfulglick character who is wondering how they can best deliver justice in a way that is also compassionate, that both compassionate to the victims of violence and to the perpetrators at the same time. The lawful good character is not the one who is necessarily seeking vengeance. They're seeking justice, perhaps retribution, but they're not out to torture people because they did something wrong.
Right. You can be punitive without enjoying it.
And of course, you can tell the way that we're describing it, like, everything's kind of loosey-goosey. Like, where do you draw the line? Who do you kill? When is it okay to kill? These are the things that provide the tension to the lawful good character, because the lawful neutral character just shoots someone in the face.
Right, yeah. Sorting out these questions is the reason lawful good is compelling, frankly.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. What are some reasons that you might want to saddle yourself with these mores and play a lawful good character?
Well, it is the way to be the brave and archetypal hero. This is the, you know, again, the knight in shining armor, the one that NPCs look up to, who always does what's right and never just takes the easy way out.
You're also the character who's probably most likely, I mean, other than the chaotic barbarian, I guess, to go down in a blaze of glory.
Well, a blaze of friend-loving glory.
Yeah, right? Yeah, like, the one who's like the Gandalf.
Yeah, exactly.
Who says, "Fly, you fools." Yeah. Who takes the last stand.
You shall not pass.
Yeah. Also, if you're looking for a character that has easy motivations to play, Lawful Good is where it's at. Do you save the village? Of course you save the village. Do you want to go out and win renown and have everyone know your name? Yes, of course you want to do that. If you meet a quest giver and they say, you know, my child is missing off in the woods and I know it's not the thing that you're here to do, but could you go look for them? Of course you go do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, lawful good we talk about as being the conflicted and complicated one, but in some ways it can also, if you want to avoid moral quandary, lawful good is also the easy one. It's just like, you just go do the right thing. You don't really have to get into a game examining, like, what is right, right? You don't have to pose moral questions, and lawful good just does the good thing.
Yeah, I think definitely there's some times as a GM where you're like, you know what I want to run? Just a short game where everyone's good and does the right thing.
Yeah, where orcs are bad and people are good and orcs are doing bad things, so we're going to go stop them. Like, I don't need a moral quandary here. I don't need to wonder if the people have infringed on the orcs' land.
Right, there's no shades of gray here. Right. Like, the mayor is not like a Rakshasa in disguise.
Right.
we're going to do the thing. We're going to save the people. We're going to come back and things will be better because we succeeded.
Exactly. They're going to put a statue of us in the center of town and we're going to be happy about it.
Yeah, we deserved it. And we're not going to be like, well, we really should have spent that money on food for the poor.
Exactly.
Now, if you do want to play a little more conflicted when you're playing lawful good, you can be that character who is a beacon in a dark world. So especially in something like a Points of Light setting where you have, you know, small pockets of civilization and in between them is dark wilderness, wandering monsters, evil empires, things like that. It can be hard not to compromise your values when you never have an out and out win, when like nothing seems to go right. So if you're thinking Dark Sun or like 40K, these settings where things are kind of grim, it's hard to be the knight in shining armor all the time, but it can be fun or at least interesting to be the person who is striving to live up to these very, very high ideals in a world that says, why is this that important? We're just trying to stay alive. That also means you can be the character who is forced to make tough decisions. You have one antidote to a deadly plague. Do you give it to the king? Or, because they are smaller, do you give it to multiple children who can then survive? Okay, if the easy answer is, well, obviously you give it to the kids because you're a good person. Well, what happens if the king's death will then result in a bloody civil war? Right. Then what do you do?
Yep, you can always get into the question of good versus greater good.
Right.
It's also a great way to play against type. So if you're in a setting where half-orcs are perceived to be a certain way, you know, the half-orc paladin who's fighting against type can be really rewarding. Or, you know, if your dragons are metallic good and chromatic bad, you know, what if you were a good aligned red dragon?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons that we really like Eberron, is you mix things up.
Right.
It's a green dragon. I don't know if they're good or bad.
And then Lawful Good also gives you more room to fall. if you want to be a tragic hero, descend into darkness. The best place to start is the top.
Yeah. I've never questioned these standards before, and yet I've got a whole campaign in front of me.
Right.
Okay, so as a Lawful Good character in the world, what are some reasons that you're actually out there joining a party or like digging through dungeons rather than like administering justice in a court of law?
The simplest is usually either you've been ordered to do it or you have a duty to do it. You have some authority that has prescribed this will happen, so you go do it.
Yeah, you're a questing knight. The queen was like, go do this thing. And you're like, yep, that's what I do. Of course I do that.
Exactly.
I also like the idea of being bound by your word. Like, it doesn't have to be an authority figure who has tasked you with going out into the world. It could be that you just made a promise to someone, to anyone. And because you made a promise, it doesn't matter who it was to. It doesn't matter what it is about. You must fulfill it because your word is your bond.
Right. As long as it's in good faith.
I mean, I guess I could see a lawful good character who's like, yes, I was charmed. Yes, I was geshed. But I said it. And therefore, duty demands that I fulfill it.
Yeah, sure, but I mean, you're not going to go out and like commit mass murder because of duty. That would not make you lawful good.
But you might go out and figure out some way within the bounds of honor to satisfy both.
Okay, maybe. That feels like a lawful neutral thing. You're honor bound to your word, but you will not do something terrible, even if it is. It's like the Wookiee life debt thing, right? Like. Like how many children are you going to murder for your Wookiee life debt before you just kind of decide that it's not worth it to you?
Four.
Yeah, that's
how
my
many
number.
Kids did Han and Leia have?
37. Wait, no. Four.
I mean, they just kept having more because Chewbacca kept murdering them.
Exactly. We don't ever talk about the ones behind.
Yeah, although canonically we can tell Chewbacca does not murder children of Han and Leia because he totally could have hit Ben Solo in the face. He hit him in the side instead.
That's a good point.
Yeah. All right, it could also be that there is just great evil in the world and you need to go stop it because you can.
Lawful good characters are also sometimes motivated by glory or just a quest, right? Some greater purpose.
Yeah, hunt for the Holy Grail. This is the archetype.
Right.
And I love the idea that you are out in the world because of one life. Whatever you're doing out here, whatever you're trying to find, whatever you're trying to fix, is just to save one life that is important to you, and that's it.
Padme.
You know, from a certain perspective, I think the Jedi are evil.
I don't want to get into this bullshit.
Okay, so if you are playing Lawful Good, or you are running a game for Lawful Good characters, one of the best things to put in is moral dilemmas, because these are some of the best role-playing opportunities for these kinds of characters. But there are different ways that you can deal with your moral dilemma that you're presented with. The first one is just accept the suffering. It's a role-playing hook for you. You don't necessarily need to solve the thing that is making your life difficult. You just play out the fact that it makes your life kind of suck. It's pretty common in romantic tragedies. You know, you're married for a family alliance, but you're in love with someone else. But you're already married. You can't get divorced. You can't have an affair. You just can't be together. You just sort of love each other from afar all the time. That's a nice backdrop to a character.
Mm-hmm.
Lancelot and Guinevere. They did a little more than love each other from afar.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
But they're having this affair, and they just feel awful about it the whole time.
I mean, I'm not going to stop, but I feel really bad.
Yeah, yeah. Afterward, I'll feel really bad about this.
Right.
What do you want to do about Mordred? Nothing. He's harmless. He's harmless.
This also works well with like family tradition as well. You know, if your family has a tradition of being, you know, clerics of a certain deity.
Dwarves. Then, dwarves, man.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's very dwarven. But, you know, if your family is all clerics of a certain deity, then you become a cleric of that deity, even if that isn't really where your heart is, right? You always wanted to be a sneaky rogue.
Or worship a different god.
Right.
And you're like, crap.
My heart's not in this.
These spells are really hard to cast for some reason. I also like when you are presented with a dilemma, you find a better way to solve it that is also usually harder. So, you know, you do what is the good thing and then accept the punishment that is meted out by lawful authorities because you submit to their authority. So if you refuse a command on the battlefield, either because you think it is a bad command or it will get your army killed, or you think it's an evil act, then afterward, you resign the commission or you accept the fact that you're going to get executed for it.
Yeah, I mean, this is often the way that you land an NPC in jail. As a GM, you know, give your other player or give the players a chance to stage a jailbreak because you know that person will not resist.
Other party members, if you're playing with the paladin, right? There are often probably will be times where they're like, "Oh no, I need to like give myself up. I need to turn myself in." Okay, let them do that, and then get them out of there so the game can continue.
Exactly. Right. Right. The other part of this is to, you know, take a burden onto yourself. So a paladin or a monk who takes a vow of poverty, who gives away all of the wealth that they earn to like an orphanage or a temple.
Yeah, they could lead a revolt, overthrow the system, and try to like reinstitute something that will be more just and fair. But that's something that a chaotic good character might do. Lawful good thinks that's probably going to cause more harm than it will actually fix, and so tries to work within the system. So alignment is a way to describe how characters interact with the world, especially the other people in it. So who are some of the people that it's most interesting for lawful good characters to interact with?
So authority figures are a good starting place. You know, a lawful good character probably defers to a greater authority if they recognize that authority. And just by default, they're probably going to recognize anybody's authority.
Yeah, they think that order is better than anarchy, so it's possible that even a tyrant might be preferable to wanton destruction that might result if no one was in charge. And as a lawful good character, it's a good opportunity for you to act as an advisor to other authority figures who may not follow your same ethos. You can suggest good alternatives, like quote-unquote good alternatives, and phrase it in a way that, you know, even a greedy mayor might think sounds really good to them.
They will also interact with enemies.
I think we argue about this a lot. Like, how should a lawful good character treat enemies?
Yeah, in a world where you don't level up if you don't kill things, largely. And you can't be a pacifist in D&D, effectively.
We tried that once.
Right. So given those two things, how do you square that behavior with your ideals?
I think in general, even if you are a lawful good character who kills, you don't cause more suffering than is necessary. So obviously you don't torture. You don't usually try to beat a confession out of someone. If you have the opportunity to kill enemies, if you can kill them with one clean cut with a sword, you probably choose that over burning them slowly to death.
Yeah, you also likely respect humanity, so you wouldn't desecrate bodies, you wouldn't kill families or hold hostages, you probably aren't so cool with undead either, and you definitely wouldn't kill anybody who's a prisoner or, you know, has surrendered, that sort of thing.
You might offer opportunities for surrender. You also might just offer opportunities for repentance, which in-game probably is much easier to deal with.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I want you to be able to die without guilt on your head, but, you know, you're going to die.
Right.
And if you're religiously motivated, you might take the opportunity to try to convert them. Again, maybe right before you kill them, maybe before you take them prisoner.
What about interacting with chaotic characters?
You murder them all. As soon as they ping chaotic, you stab them in the face, because that's what they would do.
I think more reasonably, you're going to see them as sort of flighty or not trustworthy, maybe unpredictable because they don't adhere to the system around them.
Yeah, if they have power, you might think that they are going to end up as a danger to themselves or even others. But you could also look at them and think that, you know, they're really creative, and you might even envy the way that they can relax a lot more easily. So I don't think that there necessarily needs to be conflict between a lawful good character and then chaotic characters, particularly in the same party. I think you can respect each other's differences as long as they don't become too philosophical.
Right.
But what about evil characters?
I mean, that's always the million-dollar question at the end of the campaign, right? Do you redeem the evil bad guy, or do you just put them down?
You put them down because they're worth XP. And then you can get their spell scrolls and loot their chest.
Well, if you play old school D&D, you can just steal all their stuff and then you get the XP for their gold.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's just for gold.
Right.
Done. Easy. You put them to work so they earn gold. So then they give you their gold.
Right.
You enslave them. Oh, wait. No, wait. That doesn't work.
Lawful good typically, though, doesn't really have trouble just killing evil things. You know, you're evil, you gotta go.
So this gets slightly different when you're talking about party members. If you have other lawful good party members, maybe you're holding each other to a very high standard or an even higher standard. Maybe there's even a competition about who is gooder or is most invested in the particular precepts of the law.
Yeah, and then the non-lawful party members, you might respect that they have skills and experience that you don't. And this is where you get into that kind of silly, fun, dramatic irony situation where, you know, the party is doing things that the lawful good paladin would not approve of, but you're kind of doing them behind his back, but he kind of must know that these things are ill-gotten gains, but he's kind of looking the other way, and also don't throw it in his face and he won't make a big deal of it.
Yeah, and you know, the table can decide, is this happening with the player's knowledge? I mean, it should be happening with the player's knowledge. Is it happening with only the player's knowledge and not the character's? Does the character also eventually catch on and then kind of go, why don't I go talk to the magistrate alone, and you guys, I don't know, stay here and don't get into trouble?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they, you know, go do the B&E that is necessary.
Right.
And I think in a party, you know, we talk a lot about, I think old versions of D&D were like, a paladin would never travel in a party with an evil character. But I think a more nuanced approach to this realizes that even paladins don't smite their mothers. Like, we've talked about before, in a party, you can be like a monster and eventually other people will accept you because you watch each other's backs, you know? So a party member of an opposing alignment may get under your skin, but they can become part of your family or maybe like part of your squad if like you come from a soldier background. Order of the Stick, everyone knows that Belkar is evil, but Roy doesn't stab him in the head. He's part of his party.
Right, and he's got useful skills.
Yeah.
As long as he doesn't dead anybody he's not supposed to dead, it's okay.
Well, not too many times, or at least as long as he makes up for it.
Right.
So, lawful good is probably the alignment that has the most questions from people, like on forums or online, or just like, you know, horror stories from other people in the gaming community. It has so many potential pitfalls from people who are very wedded to this alignment. So what are some of them and what are some of the ways to sort of avoid them?
I think the one that most people have probably heard of, lawful stupid.
But that's my favorite alignment.
So this is the example of the lawful good paladin, almost always, who just cannot see, like, the world as a three-dimensional shape, right? Like, there is simply black and white, there is simply good and evil, and it's like, if you're not the utmost upstanding person, then you are evil.
Yeah, this grew out of abilities in older versions of D&D where paladins could just detect someone's alignment because it was like an objective, observable thing, and you just go, oh, the innkeeper is evil. He's greedy and he probably swindles people, so he's evil, right? But I'm a paladin and he is evil, and so I murder
so
the
I must
innkeeper.
Kill him. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Lawful stupid also often ends up in self-sacrifice to the point of stupidity. This is the Blaze of Glory problem. So you're defending a village and the paladin spies the ogre and says, this ogre is evil and we must destroy evil at all costs, and so I charge. And of course they get splatted. Of course they die. Even if they make it to level 10, they're going to do the same thing with a red dragon. Of course they die.
Right. Yeah, the idea that because of lawful good alignment, you have no sense of self-preservation.
Right, or tactics.
Right. Yeah. No. Also no long view whatsoever.
Right.
No greater good that you could accomplish by being alive.
And, you know, maybe this problem solves itself. You no longer have the dumb paladin to deal with. But they often carry the party into danger, too, because now everyone knows where the rogue is.
Right.
Also, just as a table topic, they outshine or they steal the spotlight from other characters who are trying to do more interesting things like subterfuge or deception or even just analysis.
Right. So the key to avoiding becoming lawful stupid as a character is to play lawful good as more of a personality trait and not always like an action decision tree, right?
Yeah, or even playing lawful stupid, but as a personality trait. So you could have the paladin sort of say out loud, you know, we should charge them. I'm going to charge the ogre. Okay, let's charge the ogre. And then that gives everyone else an opportunity to like tackle them and be like, wait, no, don't do that. Hold on, that's a bad idea.
Yeah. You can be impulsively dumb about being good, but you just have to be open to not always getting to do it.
Right. Like maybe you never lie because lying is a terrible act. And so when you're, you know, talking to the vizier, you are about to blurt out the truth because that's what you do. And then other characters have the opportunity to shut you up. But you still, you know, have fun with the, I am about to do a dumb thing.
Right.
I think it's sort of the same thing as a like archetypal barbarian who's just like, I don't understand manners,
so I smash things.
Right.
Yeah, this kind of character can be refreshing in a party, especially if you've got a lot of like schemers and sort of murky morality floating around your party. This can give you a sense of moral clarity that helps sort of become the sort of the center of the party, right? You can kind of keep things moving in the direction that the campaign is supposed to be going in.
Yeah, it's a nice beat when everyone else is like, okay, so like what do we get out of this, and like what's the best way to tackle this, and the kind of dumb paladin just sort of steps up and like,
no, we are not murdering these children. Like,
that's, why would we ever do that?
Yeah, no, I don't care how much money we can get for them, we're not doing it.
And hey, great, done. You sort of saw to the heart of that matter.
Right.
And if you're in a party with someone like this, make sure that you do sometimes give them time to shine, you know, maybe in that beat moment, or maybe there just is a time when it'd be really great for them to charge the big dumb ogre as a distraction.
Right.
The other thing I think that sort of results in many a paladin's fall is the slippery slope of choosing law over good. So I think, and I don't know, maybe Shane, maybe you disagree, but I think that the moral axes, so good versus evil, demand more from a character to stick to them than the ethical law versus chaos axis. Because if you're in a situation where you choose law over good, you're basically leaning toward lawful neutral. You know, you can choose good over law and still be lawful, because I think most real people would say that the law exists in order to uphold the good, not that, you know, good must be tossed aside to uphold law.
Interesting. I don't think that's true at all.
Really?
I don't think there's any more demand on the moral side than there is on the social side.
That's interesting, because again, I feel like if you are not actively pursuing doing evil things, it just so happens that you're evil and you're a tyrant, or like the actions that you take in order to maintain control as a tyrant, bad things happen to people. I think that kind of puts you as lawful neutral, bordering lawful neutral, lawful evil. I think in order to really be like lawful evil, you've got to be like, I'm a tyrant, I want to maintain control, and I also want to crush you under my boot.
Okay, interesting.
If you're not doing the crushing, I think you're just lawful neutral.
Okay. I mean, that's fine. I mean, I think if you set up an evil and corrupt system, then you're becoming lawful evil yourself, right? Simply setting up a dictatorial regime just makes you neutral, sure. But it's what the result of that regime is how you get to the moral standard of it, right?
Are you saying this just because you're lawful evil?
First of all, I'm chaotic evil.
I thought Cameron was chaotic evil. No, yeah, no, he's chaotic neutral.
I'm neutral evil.
Okay. Okay, but so what I'm saying is, if for example you are playing in a system that has a code of Hammurabi, right, and the penalty for stealing is death, if you see a starving urchin steal some food, and then you decide, okay, what I'm going to do is uphold the law and kill the urchin, as opposed to letting them go because that is a good thing to do, that is a very quick way to head toward lawful neutral, not lawful good. Whereas if you say, I'm going to help the urchin and ignore the law,
that's a very quick way to get to neutral good instead of lawful good. because you've decided that the law is less important to you, which is fine. And also, it's like a single action doesn't dictate your alignment, right? Like, the alignment is flexible for that reason. So, like, you can be lawful good as an ideal and still have to make wrong decisions, right? Like, a good person who does one bad thing doesn't become evil.
But killing two urchins probably makes you no longer good.
Well, that's why it's a slippery slope. And a slope.
It's more of a trapdoor, really.
All right, so how many urchins do I got to kill?
It's four. How many kids did Leon Han have?
How long until I get that Blackguard prestige class?
You got to get higher and higher before you can flip it, okay?
Right, exactly.
So I do think if you want to be lawful good and play lawful good, the thing you need to look out for is the trope of the paladin who is so lawful that they essentially become evil.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other problem we kind of mentioned, which is really more of a table issue, is that you're playing a character who's just too good for the world. Every time you beat an enemy, you give them a chance to surrender, and if they do surrender, then you escort them to safety, even if you're inside a dungeon. Like, it totally derails the plot.
Yeah, this becomes a problem when your alignment is clashing with the tone of a setting or the tone of the game you're playing, right? If you've all decided to play Underhive gangers who are just, you know, fighting and killing and scrapping for survival, then you can't be the one with a code of honor who just refuses to do those things, because now you've stopped the game.
Yeah, or you might need to tone down your code of honor, right? Maybe it's not I am a shining beacon. It's compared to everyone around me, I'm a shining beacon.
Right.
There's also the sort of Batman philosophy, which is I'm not going to kill you, but I don't need to save you. So, yes, we took you prisoner. I don't need to escort you out of this dungeon. You built this dungeon. I'm going to tie you up with some rope. I'm going to stick you in a corner. And, you know, if you get eaten by carrion crawlers, that's your own problem. Why did you stock carrion crawlers?
Yeah. Or there's the Batman versus Superman morality. In which case, a giant fight that causes, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars of damages to a city center, it won't hurt anybody, will it? That's Friday afternoon. No one's at work.
I think it's important, if you're playing lawful good who has very high standards for themselves, you don't have to like what's happening. You can go along with something. You can say, all right, fine, this is how things are going to be, and still be like, but my character is grumpy about it and doesn't like it and wants to change it at some point. But you're not like suddenly whipping out your sword and cutting heads off.
Yeah, you don't need to play brinkmanship on every disagreement, right? Like, you don't have... Yeah, that doesn't have to be on the table every single time that you have an argument with a rogue that one of you loses a hand. It's going to be the rogue, though. Because you're better with the sword.
One hand for the rogue, and then...
Right.
Sneak attack, baby! You gotta sleep sometime. That's why all of my paladins are elves.
You gotta sleep sometime with the fishes.
Okay, so if you're running a game for a lawful good character, what are some cool, interesting plot hooks that you can give them?
Well, you could be working for the devil.
Yeah, I love this one. Sure, you're tasked with something, and your honestly, admittedly, pretty bad evil patron is going to benefit. But so will so many other good people. Or, you know, maybe the evil person is the only one benefiting, but you have been assigned this duty. You need to escort the ambassador of a rival country somewhere. You certainly can't let them get killed. They look down on you. They think you're a big, dumb jerk.
Right.
And they have no problem putting themselves in danger because you need to jump in the way.
Yeah, and you can kind of see where that line is of how much can they get away with before you have to put your foot down on, I will not let this stand.
Before you have to put your foot down on their neck.
Right, exactly.
There's also the scenario where you just know that someone is evil, that they are the horrible mastermind behind the plague, but you just have no proof. You can't prove it in court. This is one of those situations where if you were chaotic, you would just break into their house or you would wring their neck until they confess. But you don't do that. You can't do that. You'll fall, right?
Right.
Like, Paylor's not cool with that.
Exactly. Yeah, so you've got to go around and build the actual legal case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's possible that actually none of what they're doing is illegal, right? The corporate executive who's dumping toxic waste somewhere might have a permit to dump that toxic waste. It doesn't mean that people aren't getting hurt.
Right.
So are you guys doing a shadow run to figure out how they're doing it, or maybe just to find leverage on them? There's also offering them the breaking point. So if you're playing a lawful good character and you always have to deal with like people who aren't living up to your standards, and you have to like deal with people who are evil, but like you can't just murder them in the street, there's always that tension of like, I just want things to be better. And it can be really nice to present an opportunity where some NPC or enemy had just does something so horrible and awful that no one is going to think that the lawful good character was out of line if they just summarily execute this person.
Right.
We discover the torture chamber. The vizier didn't mean to like show us the torture chamber. He's standing right there. I cut off his head. Of course I cut off his head. And like, consequences be damned. This is awful.
Right. But now the party as a whole has to deal with those consequences, right? The vizier is dead after all.
Yeah. And this is usually something you'll want to talk with like above the table first before one player derails an entire game. It can be a nice plot point that people are kind of prepared for.
Yeah. And you can also do some poking and prodding as a GM, kind of, man, you see this. You're lawful good. Are you going to let this stand? You know, like, do you really think the vizier should live after this?
This seems pretty awful to you.
Yeah, exactly.
It could also be a nice opportunity for others in the party, yeah, like the neutral good person, or heck, the like true neutral or chaotic neutral person to go, oh my god, that's terrible.
No,
that's
chaotic
awful.
Evil. It's the chaotic evil person is the one where that's your win, right? It's like, no, this is too much.
This, you are torturing these people all wrong.
Right.
This is inappropriate.
No, I mean, chaotic evil can also not be okay with torture. Yeah. like there is a line, right?
I just rip their heads off, okay? I don't make it last. I'm not a monster. Well, I'm a monster, but...
So... In conclusion, I think the best advice we can give for lawful good players or players of lawful good characters is, ironically, it helps to be flexible in your interpretation of what lawful good means within your game world and within the moral choices that you're forced to make.
Yeah, I think no matter how stringent or uptight your character is, you as a player can find ways that they can coexist pretty happily with almost anyone else at the table with a little bit of work and maybe a little bit of smiting. Maybe a lot of bit of smiting.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
I accidentally leaned against your fireplace mantle and I believe... Oh, nope. That's a torture chamber, Shane. That's inappropriate.
That's actually the access to the Character Creation Forge, and we are torturing characters in there right this very moment.
Oh, that is... Oh, we have hacked them apart into tiny pieces and put them back together in horrible ways.
No, I'm sorry. The only thing we're torturing is this metaphor.
We can keep going. It's not dead yet.
Before we move on to the Character Creation Forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram, at TotalPartyThrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building... Goody Two Shoes.
So, like storm themed characters and shadow themed characters, now that we have Xanathars, there are just so many divine themed subclasses. Like, there's just so many ways to get healing spells and to worship a different deity or something. So, we're just trying to cram a bunch of them into one build.
Yeah, so let's go pull all of them down. So, the build is Devotion Paladin 10, Celestial Warlock 2, Divine Soul Sorcerer 5, and Zealot Barbarian 3.
Okay, so from Paladin, you get a cool fighting style, probably great weapon fighting. You get smite, extra attack, you get that juicy save bonus, immunity to charm, and eventually immunity to fear. Celestial Warlock gets you a nice little pool of healing d6s and a couple of invocations. It's kind of your choice on what you pick. Devil Sight is maybe not the most thematic, just right. Throwing that out there.
Angel Sight.
Yeah. and you've got spell slots that refresh on a short rest, which is key.
Yeah, then the Divine Soul Sorcerer gets favored by the gods, so you get a chance to roll 2d4 and add it to your result when you fail a saving throw or an attack once per short rest.
You get a couple of meta magic options, and you get sorcery points, which is also important.
Then for Zealot Barbarian, you will get Rage Resistance as well as the damage bonus. You will get Reckless Attack, so you can grant yourself advantage as well as Trap Sense. And then you get the Zealot subclass's bonus to damage, and you are easy to raise from the dead.
So this might be familiar to some of you. It's Paladin Warlock Sorcerer. The key is you've got the smite cycle. You've got the spell slots that refresh on a short rest from Warlock, so you can smite with those, so you're pretty much never out of smites. But you can also, anytime you take a short rest, feed those into sorcery points that you can then convert to spell slots, which you can then use to smite.
Right.
So as long as you can get a short rest, you actually have many opportunities to smite.
Correct.
Now, some of you might think, oh, well, this is a coffee lock. I'm not going to explain it. Just don't do it, okay? It's not good at the table. In terms of leveling order, you probably want to do Paladin 5 to get extra attack. Warlock 2, Knockout Sorcerer, Knockout Barbarian, then finish off Paladin.
So, Ishin, who is your goody two shoes?
So, I think Asimar is the obvious choice for race here, but I like Tiefling. And a Tiefling who can't get a god to notice them. No god wants this Tiefling. And so she says, you know what? I'm going to prove to you how good I am. Probably starts off as a barbarian out in the wilderness and then discovers that her zealotry has granted her some, you know, sort of divine capabilities. And then finally is not able to locate a god, but makes contact with a celestial, a slightly lower level celestial, an angel who says, you know what? I see goodness in you. I'm going to give you a chance, and then forms a pact. Then, you know, awakens magic within them and eventually takes holy orders. And says, fine, you didn't want me. I don't need to be a cleric. I don't even want to be a cleric, but I can be the best of the best out there. I'm going to be the holiest of holy warriors. Also, I have resistance to fire, which is really nice. It's handy.
All right. I see you.
What about your goody two shoes?
So my goody two shoes sees the world a little bit differently from everybody else. Very, very strong sense of moral code and kind of lawful disposition, but can't quite find the right fit for how to implement that in the world. So she kind of just drifts between different divine orders and divine callings, trying to find the right deity and the right set of skills that will allow her to manifest her worldview. So probably like yours, starts as a zealot, finds out that, you know, maybe just mindless battle is not the correct way to do this. Then makes a pact with a celestial, finds out, hey, you know, celestials, not really deities. The divine soul is kind of that spark from within. Maybe that's where she finds her inspiration and realizes like, wait, maybe I am the deity. Maybe divinity is within. That doesn't advance too far because apparently she doesn't have more than just a barest spark of divinity, but she is devoted this entire time, and she finally finds a paladin order that sees things her way, some, you know, Knights Templar or equally kind of ambitious order.
So a divine dilettante.
Exactly.
Perfect.
All right, before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this every single week.
And just a reminder, you can find the Goody Two Shoes build, as well as every other build we've ever made in the Character Creation Forge, in the Character Creation Forge Codex, which is available either on our website, on Patreon, or in the show notes of this very episode.
And if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about rolling in the open.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the Holy Roller.
Well, that's it for episode 131 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishin. Thanks for listening.